Although this was not a question that Jesus asked in the flesh, because this was after his ascension, this was the story, or is the story, of Paul, or Saul, more correctly, on the road to Damascus. It is nonetheless a question that Jesus asked, because he came to Saul and he said, what? Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? And so what I want us to think about tonight as we're looking at this particular chapter or this series of verses here is plug your name into that. Richard, Richard, why do you persecute me? Novell, Novell, why do you persecute me? Is that a question that we want Jesus to ask of us? Well, do we or are we? We're all here. It's Wednesday night. I mean, this is the best of the best, right? Except for those that are at camp. Understood. Is that a question that we think is really a fair question for us? Do we do anything that persecutes Jesus? Like Saul did? No. Because what did Saul do in his persecution? But do we do other things that could be considered a persecution? Either what we do or don't do, or what we say or don't say, how we conduct ourselves in front of others. Could we be guilty of falling within that category and having to be asked that question? So as we look at this tonight, think about that as we go through the lesson, because that's where we're going to end up with Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? Or your name filled in the blank. Why do you persecute me? Acts chapter 9, starting with verse 1. Then Saul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked letters from him to the synagogues of Damascus, so that if he found any who were of the way, whether men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. We know who he's talking about when he's talking about the way, right? Christians of the first century. You, me. The way. That's how the church was referred to. On that road, as he went down that path, he had what on his mind? Breathing threatenings and... Your version probably says slaughter if you have the New King James. I think the regular King James says slaughter. I think the American Standard says murder. I'm not sure about that, but the Greek word is murder. Okay? Threatenings in the Greek is just what it says it is. It's threatenings. And I think that's pretty clear. We know what threatenings is. If I walk up to Joe and threaten him within an inch of his life, we understand that concept, which I've done a couple of times. Love you, Joe. But going up and intending to or anticipating committing murder is a step beyond that. And that's what Saul did participate in, was capable of doing, was intending to do. Who was at the stoning of Stephen? Saul was. If he didn't participate in actually throwing the rocks, then what was laid at his feet while he stood there and watched? Okay? Two chapters earlier. So we know what Saul is capable of. And we know what he did. And he went to the high priest and he said, I need permission in order to do this. Now, is that any different? Put in today's time. Is there any difference between Paul, or, and I'm going to say, I know I'm going to do this all night. I'm going to say Paul when his name at this point is Saul. I'm going to say Saul when later I mean Paul. Just, you know where I'm going. Paul or Saul. Is that any different? Is Saul any different in going to the high priest and asking for those letters than is perhaps the ACLU going to their legislators and asking for the reading of scriptures in a public place to be considered a hate crime? or for any activist group bringing a lawsuit and going before a court to have Christianity stifled in some way or form. Is there a lot of difference between the two? I don't know that there is there? Would one of those activist groups today think about committing murder in order to stifle us? I don't know of any that have, but there's plenty of examples of aberrant behavior in today's society that is, I guess, nothing surprises me anymore. Solomon made it clear that what is new under the sun? Absolutely, zip, zero, nada, nothing. So if I woke up tomorrow morning and I saw that a particular group had gone out and committed murder in order to keep the word of God from being spread, I don't know that it would surprise me a whole lot.
How do you consider abortion?
How do I consider abortion?
Well, speaking of murder.
As murder, as the taking of human life, yes. I mean, so we've got, in a lot of similar circumstances, the same thing going on today with people just like Saul or just like Paul. Pat? Well, we're getting... No, not quite yet. But I'm not so sure that's not where we're heading. Threatenings, as used here in Acts chapter 9, one of the words I looked up, or one of the synonyms that was in the Strong's Dictionary, was menace. We use the term menace to society a lot. Paul was a menace. Saul, see, I'm doing it again. Saul was a menace. But yet, isn't it ironic that there are those that consider Christians to be a menace to society in today's time? I ran across an article, and I'm going to chase a rabbit briefly. I normally don't, but I read this editorial that was in the back of a magazine the other day, and I was thinking about because I was also studying this lesson, and I was thinking about Saul and his, what do we know about Saul personally as far as his background? We know that he was a highly educated person, right? He had studied at the feet of whom? We know that he had a trade, which was, and I'm not so sure our society wouldn't be all the better for that today. A trade was part of a higher education. Paul was a tent maker. We know that he was extremely important, not only on the Jewish side of the government, but highly respected by the Romans as well, because he was doing things that were keeping the Jewish society out of the hair of the Romans. And I was thinking about this business of being highly educated, and a lot of our issues that we have in today's society started out in the ivory halls of academia and have filtered their way down. And here's Paul, a very educated man of his particular time, going out and threatening and murdering the Christians. And I'm thinking, this is today. So, and I ran across this article, and the two just fit together. So it's a little bit of a rabbit chase. It's not entirely a rabbit chase. Selected excerpts from this editorial. The Texas State Board of Education met in Austin earlier this year to consider the new version of the Texas Essential Knowledge and Skills for Science for grades K through 12. This is the School Textbook Committee. Okay? These science standards are important because, done properly, they prepare Texas students for modern technical life. But they are also important nationally because Texas is a large market for textbooks. Decisions here can affect the teaching of science nationally as publishers adapt to Texas standards. Unfortunately, some of the 15 board members, including Chairman Don McElroy, have an intelligent design agenda and are determined to shape the standards to their antiquated anti-scientific worldview. He goes through a paragraph about the good news is such and such. I'm not going to read that. I'm skipping around. The bad news is that intelligent design supporters inserted subtle, insidious language into the standards that undermines the description of the scientific method and its powers of elucidation. I've got to stop for just a minute. Does anybody in here know what elucidation means? I do, because I looked it up, and that's the only way that I know. It means an act of explaining that which serves to clear up and cast light upon. All right? So to read that sentence again, undermines the description of the scientific method and its powers of shining the light on that which we're observing. Okay? This phrase could mean understanding statistical and systematic errors, but in this context, it undermines the rigorous application of the scientific method because all sides should include the intelligent design side according to some board members. For Earth and space science, the specific figure of about 14 billion years for the universe's age has been removed. In another place, the requirement that the student will know how Earth-based astronomical observations reveal information about the structure, scale, composition, origin, and history of the universe is weakened by adding, quote, differing theories about the structure, end quote. Observations do not reveal theories. This wording distorts the scientific process and leaves room for interpretation that theories are equivalent to beliefs. Well, theories are equivalent to beliefs. Aren't they? Aren't they equivalent? Now, we can talk about this any way we want to, but ultimately, evolution is still a theory. Because evolution is a theory. It is still a theory. It has not been scientifically proven. And we only have to ask apologetics and press to come down here and do another seminar on that in order to prove that point from those who are PhDs in science, not from me, a CPA. Because I know sheep dip from Shinola when it comes to some science stuff. But you know, even though... And I was thinking when I read this, I'm not a scientist. But when I was in high school, I had a Christian science teacher. He taught me 9th grade physical science. He taught me 10th grade chemistry and in the 12th grade physics. Because at the time, that's all I took was science classes. I didn't know that I knew what a debit and a credit was. It wasn't until I couldn't handle organic chemistry in college that I started to understand what debits and credits were. Yeah. Organic chemistry kept me from being a pharmacist. I want you to know that. But that's all right, because now I understand debits are on the left, credits are on the right, and life is good. But that science teacher he taught me the scientific method, and not a single time did it impact me negatively in my Christianity. Not once did anything he taught me conflict with being a Christian. And I will never forget in the 9th grade, one of the students asked him in that physical science class, "Mr. Dempsey, how old is the earth?" And he says, "Well, I believe it's 10,000 years old." And everybody kind of perked up and said, now keep in mind too, when I was in school, we did not study evolution. The terms Mesozoic and Paleozoic and all that kind of stuff were in the books. Precambrian, on and on and on, were in the books, but we did not study evolution as a scientific theory. Biology teacher, 11th grade, touched on it, but didn't teach it. But at any rate, 9th grade, and Mr. Dempsey said, "I believe it's 10,000 years old." And follow-up question was, "Well, where do you get that?" And he says, "Because if you go back in the Bible and you count up all the years from the beginning of time and Adam until now, you come up with about 10,000. And then someone said, "Well, what about radiocarbon dating, which shows that it was X?" And then he proceeded to explain some of the flaws that are in some of the assumptions that are used with radiocarbon dating. I guess he would be fired if he did that today. I don't know.
Or jail.
Possibly. But our education has caused us, in many cases, to feel that we are the only people that we can depend upon. Now, maybe that was part of Paul's psyche. I don't know, because I wasn't there. But I thought it was an interesting connection with Paul being as highly educated as he was, as zealous as he was, thinking that he was doing God's will as he went about persecuting the Christians of that particular time. Now, back to Acts chapter 9, because I think we left, I don't know if we really left it, but we did divert from it a little bit. Going to verse 3. But in going it happened, as he drew near to Damascus, even suddenly a light from heaven shone around him. And he fell to earth, and he heard a voice saying to him, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? And he said, Who are you, Lord? And the Lord said, I am Jesus whom you persecute. It is hard for you to kick against the goads. What do you think Paul saw? Saul, on the road to Damascus. Put yourself there. You're walking down the road and suddenly a bright light shines. How do you relate that to something? A blinding light?
Well, then it's daylight, so a blinding light would have to be great.
Would have to be bright, bright? Have you ever... Usually at night, if something flashes in front of our eyes that's extremely bright, we lose our vision for a second or two at night when our eyes are already adapted to the dark. Several of the commentators likened it to lightning. I don't have anything anywhere that will back that up other than the word suddenly, which means exactly what it says it means, could have been like a lightning flash. Whatever the case was, what did it do to Saul? And something else. There you go. It knocked him down. Or at least he fell down. Have you known anyone who's been hit by lightning? I've known several people. Some have been killed. Joe, you've been hit by lightning? Did it knock your shoes off? I would like to have been there and seen that. You were barefoot at the time.
14.
If you had had shoes on, I'm sure it would have knocked him. Did it knock you down?
Made the news.
Where was this?
In Nashville.
Made the Nashville newspaper. Little Joey Holland was knocked over by lightning. I've known two or three people on the golf course that have been hit. I knew one group of three that was playing, and I would have been there with them because it was my regular group to play. That particular day, they went and played without me. I think they didn't call me on purpose. I did have a tendency to drag them down a little bit. But they were walking up the ninth hole, lightning, and this particular hole, woods left, water right, goes back to the clubhouse, and the lightning hit a tree on the left-hand side of the fairway, and they were walking fairly down the middle of the fairway between that and the water. Knocked two of them on the ground, knocked one of them's shoes off. Now, they all got up and they went on in. They didn't finish the hole. They just walked on in. But lightning or not, we understand the concept. When that happens, something happens. Lightning's quick. It's sudden. Paul, Saul, fell to the ground. If that were you, and suddenly something like that happened, what would be the first thought that would be running through your mind? Oops. Am I dead? Please, Lord, forgive me. I'm in a bad state here. And then as soon as that lightning hit, now see, I did it. And I don't know that it was lightning. I've read too many commentaries on this. Because that's... Then suddenly that bright light shone, and Paul fell, and then the voice happened. And what did the voice say? It said, Don, Don, why do you persecute me? Saul's response was what? Who art thou, Lord? Now, I've heard some sermons that use this Saul's response to indicate that he knew who he was talking to, Jesus.
Not necessarily
so, because the word that's used for Lord is the common salutation or greeting, which is the equivalent of sir, master, mister, Lord in the term of someone's master. Doesn't necessarily mean that Saul knew that he was talking to Jesus. He used a term of respect. If that happened to us, would we know who we were talking to? But what was Saul's background up to this point? Did Saul believe that Jesus was Jesus?
No.
He did. Well, yeah, and that's what I meant when I said, do you believe that Jesus was Jesus? He didn't. He might have believed that he was a man named Jesus,
right. But
not the Son of God. He didn't believe that at this point.
He was consenting to Stephen's death, and what Stephen was preaching, and he definitely opposed to that.
Absolutely. He knew exactly what he was doing. He knew that those that were of the way were preaching that this man who was called Jesus was the Son of God. And he was bound and determined he was going to take care of everyone who felt that way. But he didn't necessarily know that as soon as the bright light shone, and as soon as he fell down, that it was Jesus that was on the other end of the bright light. But how did Jesus answer him immediately?
I am Jesus,
whom you are persecuting. No. Joe's question was, do you think Saul believed that he was persecuting Jesus? No. I don't, because if Saul was a Jew's Jew, if he was a Hebrew's Hebrew, he didn't believe that Jesus was the Son of God, plain and simple. Period. End of story. These people were blaspheming God in his eyesight. Now, everyone here probably knows someone that kind of in the back of your mind you're thinking the gospel is absolutely wasted on that person. Think about it. We know we're not supposed to think about it that way, because when we do that, we limit the power of God. But don't you know someone who you would think it was wasted breath if you went and tried to talk to them any more than you already have, or at all to begin with? Don't you know someone who's so vile and so nasty that they could not possibly ever be turned around?
I know so.
Let's clear this up. None of them are here tonight, are they? Okay. Don't we limit the power of God when we think that way? But if you ever had to think that about somebody, would you think it about Saul? Ananias, and look a few verses down there too, and look kind of carefully at the way he said it. He said, Lord, when God came to Ananias in a vision, he says, I've heard reports. There are reports. Apparently Ananias had not seen Paul face to face or witnessed the action of Saul persecuting the Christians, but he knew about it.
Saul probably would like to avoid.
Somebody that he wanted to what? Avoid?
Yes.
Well, absolutely he would be. I mean, he hesitates. He hasn't necessarily seen Paul in action himself, but he says, I've got reports, God. I'm not sure I want to go do this job. Sound like other stories? I mean, aren't there a couple of... I thought of Jonah when I was thinking about Ananias. What did God tell Jonah to go do? Go preach to Nineveh. And how did Jonah feel about the Ninevites?
Kill them.
They're not worth wasting my breath on, God. If I go over there, it's going to be a fiasco. It's going to be a worthless trip. It's going to be wasted gas. I'm not going to get anything out of it. They're not going to repent. Why do you want me to go to Nineveh?
But then he got mad because they did repent.
Well, that's true. What about Saul? Do you think if there was ever anybody who probably wouldn't come around, Saul could have been that guy? But he did, didn't he? Now, it's a little ironic. He was the apostle to the Gentiles, not the Jews, that he was the Jews' Jew of. But he came around.
He still thought what he was doing was right because he said, I lived in good conscience toward God. He thought what he was doing when he was persecuting was for God.
He did. He thought he was right 100% of the way. But he wasn't, was he? No matter how sincere we are, no matter how right we think we are, no matter how powerful in the government we might be or what a position of prestige we might have, if we're wrong, we're wrong. And Saul was, even though he didn't know it. I've known some people that I never thought in 100 years, because 1 million would be too evolutionistic. I've known people that I never thought in my lifetime I would see become Christians. And I bet we all have. But yet they did. For whatever reason, something turned them around. Maybe not something as dramatic as a light that suddenly shone in the words of Jesus, but they turned around. Saul, Saul, Richard, Richard, why do you persecute me? Now then, what did Jesus say next to Saul after he asked him why he persecuted him? Is it hard for you to kick against the goads? Who can explain that to me? You know, for the longest time, especially as a kid, I just didn't get that part. You know what a goad is? It's a cattle prod. It's a first century cattle prod. What do our cattle prods have today?
Electricity.
That modern marvel, electricity. You thought I was going to say modern miracle, didn't you, Joe? And it wouldn't have been a miracle. That's right. That modern marvel of electricity. They didn't have any electricity in those days. So on the end of that stick, there was some type of piece of metal attached to it with some type of sharp point. And the point was attached in such a way that if the animal kicked back, what would they kick? That sharp point. And then what would they do when they kicked it? They would cut their hoof. Whether you had an ox on the front or perhaps a donkey or a horse or a cow or whatever it was that you had on the front of your plow or your cart, as you were trying to get that animal to go, trying to goad that animal into doing something. Have you used that phrase before? Well, I was goaded into doing it. And maybe we didn't know what a goad was. So what's Jesus saying to Paul here? Is it hard for, it's hard for you to kick against the goads. This is Jesus whom you persecuted. The one that you're being so cruel to. And now you've kicked against the goad and you've cut your foot. How do you like me now? To put it in the words of a couple of songwriters. Yes, I am. And I don't know why. When I was studying this and saw that that was not in the American Standard, I've got Barnes, I've got Matthew Henry, I've got Zur, I've got professor at Harding, whose name escapes me, Van Tate. I've got a bunch of commentaries, and I really did not find anything talking about that not being an American Standard, whether or not what transcript it was in or was not in. I don't know. I cannot answer the question. It's going to take somebody smarter than what I am in order to go there.
Maybe they didn't know how to explain it.
Well, perhaps they didn't. I don't know, but the question there is, and it does fit with what we know of the time and the implement, and it would have been easily understood by those that Luke was writing to when it came to the goad and prodding the cattle and so on and so forth. But he asks all that question and said, well, why are you trying to kick against me? What is it I've done? Why you're trying to hurt me and now you've ended up hurting yourself. One of the English, here's my note. One of the newer English translations uses the phrase, I am the one you are so cruel to. There. And I'm not sure that's entirely accurate, but it gets across kind of the idea of what it is that we're talking about. All right, back to the question that we started the class with. Richard, why are you persecuting me? I've never seen myself as Saul. But when there's a group of people around me and they're talking badly about Christians, or they're talking about things that aren't so, or they're using examples of evolution or other things, since we talked about that earlier in the Texas science books. By the way, those of you, some of you may know how much I just cannot stand Texas. But in this particular example, go Texas. And we ought to keep up with that, and we ought to look at it in our own states as well, because every state has a school textbook committee of some sort that looks at that stuff. They all do. But if I'm standing around and there's a group of people and they're talking about the 20 billion years ago or 40 billion years ago, and I don't say anything at all, and could I be, Richard, why are you persecuting me? Could that apply? Well, it could, couldn't it? Because I didn't do anything. I didn't stand up for what God told me to stand up for. Now, do they have to listen to me? No more than what I have to listen to them, I guess. But if we looked at the example of Paul, and this is a whole nother lesson for a whole nother time and a whole nother series, but if you had to say Paul had an M.O., if he had a method of operations, what would it be? Was Paul ever going to be accused of not saying anything? If you look at the life of Paul and how he preached and how he went about spreading the gospel, he would go to a place and he would preach. And if they wouldn't accept it, he'd leave. He'd go somewhere else. And after studying the life of Paul, I'm just convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that was how Paul knew he had to be. His job was to preach it and to teach it. It was somebody else's job to accept it. But he would not and could not be found guilty on the day of judgment of not giving it an effort. That was two bells, wasn't it?
It was.
See you next week.